Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight from the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Thank you.
When the Levee Breaks, Led Zeppelin, November the 8th, 1971, from their album Led Zepp 4. First recorded by husband and wife Kansas Joe McCoy and Memphis Minnie in 1929 on a 10-inch 78 RPM.
Well, I didn't know that. I didn't know it was recorded by somebody else before. I thought it was their song. But it doesn't matter, because the only thing that's important about this song is the drum sound. That's it. That's the whole thing, because it was recorded by the famous or infamous or not well-known Andy Johns.
Andy,
that's Glyn's brother.
Yes.
Yeah. And he'd been working with Blind Faith and a number of other people. And he suggested that they use the Rolling Stones Trucks mobile.
Stones Rolling Mobile Truck one, of yeah. something. Yes.
Anyway, this
which is basically a wagon with a desk in the back of it, a recording
yeah,
desk.
Yeah. Not just a recording desk, it had a Helios in there. And it was, I think, it was the first mobile.
Yes.
And they were going to use Stargrove, which was Mick Jagger's house, and until they found out how much it was. And Mick Jagger wanted £1,000 a week for it. And Jimmy Page says, no way. So they went to Headley Grange. That's right.
So that was Jane Seymour's gaffe.
The very one, indeed. That's right. And Andy Johns came up with the idea of setting up the this Ludwig drum set in the stairwell and using two microphones. Beyer, I think they're M160s, if I remember correctly.
See.
And it's two M160s. And, you know, forget about all the hype, because we know this stuff, right? They were actually put through some of the compressors on the desk, which are the Helios compressors, which eventually came out later on rebadged as ADR, which we have a clone of in our studio. We do indeed have the ADR compressor. Right, the compressor, however, and stuck it through an echo rec as well, which is an old Benson Echo machine to add more compression. Right, and that was the sound. Two microphones. So when I see in future ever a drum set that is festooned in microphones, under snare, over snare, side snare, a snare, the drummer's culo.
Exactly, which is bottom in Spanish.
Yeah, forget it, because that is one of the ultimate drum sounds ever recorded.
It is, isn't it? Now, I was reading about that. So it was by accident, because they just dropped off a brand new Ludwig kit, hadn't they, to the house?
Correct.
And you could hear it echoing up, and it was at the bottom of the stairwell, and it's quite an old sort of mansion house, wasn't it, with the
Correct.
Big open plan staircase that went up. And that's when they went, oh my God, that sound, that's what we want.
And it was a 26-inch bass drum, rather like the same size that our man, Steve Turner, used, a Slingerland, the other week gig that we did.
Yeah, that, wow.
When we headlined the Hooded Ram tent on the Isle of Man TT.
Yeah. That was massive.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
It was.
It was a mighty sound indeed.
It was like the bowels of doom.
Do you know, the more and more I play and the more and more we do the show, it's amazing how I get to understand even more. You know, when you don't know what you don't know.
Mm.
It's one of those, I'm thinking, really? You really lift that up and there's that and then there's more to come. It's fascinating, really. But what I know, I started off by saying that it was first recorded by Memphis Minnie and her husband, Kansas Joe McCoy. But that song, I mean, that was a fantastic blues song, which is documenting the back in 1927, the Mississippi, there was a massive flood. And so that song was about that, which destroyed many homes and forced a lot of people to flee to the cities to find work. So that really saw the great migration of African Americans in the first half of the 20th century. So it has quite a, it's a historical landmark, that a real proper Delta kind of blues song. It's got history. It's dripping in history. And I love that there was one thing that it said, this is the way I love that, that When the Levee Breaks is described as an apocalyptic slice. Shall I say that again?
Yes.
An apocalyptic slice of urban blues.
To sleep and a full moon looks, and the night is so black that the darkness cooks. When you come creeping around, making me do things I don't want to do. That you need my love so bad, but come sneaking around trying to drive me mad, busting in on my dreams, making me see things I don't want to see. You're the green minor leashy with a two-pronged crown. All my trying is up, all you're bringing is down. Just taking my love then slipping away, leaving me here just trying to keep from following you.
Manalishi with two-pronged crown.
It sounds trippy and a bit scary, that title.
Well, it is trippy and scary, because I think Peter Green was at the last stages of Fleetwood Mac at that point, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. That was released as a single in May 1970, written by Peter Green, and it stayed at number 10 in the UK charts for 4 weeks. 4 weeks!
Mm.
Well, it's a really unusual song, isn't it? It's a bit haunting. It's a bit unsettling to listen to, I think.
Yeah, well, it was a funny period, because, I mean, it was rock and roll. Of course, Led Zepp 1 and 2 had come out at that point.
Yeah.
I think even 3, actually. So everybody was getting more rock, you know. And those riffs are really cool that he did there. But I think the reason why we put this on the show today is, of course, Danny Kirwan, who was on that record, and he sadly died this last week.
Yeah.
And, you know, a great guitarist. One of those guys that you know, that's there, that you don't know he's there. And he was always overshadowed by the mighty Pete Green, because who wouldn't be, you know? He really get a great contribution, I think, to Fleetwood Mac in those later days.
Yeah, carry on.
Yeah, sorry. And he also used to use, as Peter Green did, orange amps, which was a big thing, you know, with an outboard reverb tank, which was fantastic. And some years ago, well, a lot of time ago, actually, after Matt Mathias died, who actually built Matt Amp and who basically designed the orange amp. It was orange amps were like a branding exercise for Matt Amp. I went round the factory and saw some of Danny Kirwan's and Peter Green's old preamps and reverb tanks.
I bet you were in heaven,
weren't
you?
Oh, man. I tell you, I looked at them and I thought, no, did
Geek
Peter
alert.
Green actually play through that? And I went, ooh. I was like a little boy, you know, all my knees were trembling and starting to perspire, you know.
Well, that's lovely. And it's I didn't know about Danny. Obviously, you know, as you know, I don't really know too many people, especially guitarists, really. But he was discovered like at age 17, and he had a band called Boiler House, and he persuaded the mighty Mike Vernon
again
to go and see a rehearsal. So Mike Vernon rocked up, saw them in rehearsal, and told Peter Green about the band, and Green was gonna manage them, but the drummer and the bass player didn't want to go professional at the time, so. Apparently, they advertised for a new rhythm section, and after 300 people had auditioned, nobody was good enough for Peter Green to play with Danny. So what happened was that it was then suggested, well, maybe he would then join Fleetwood Mac, because obviously Peter Green knew him from jamming with him, because, well, apparently Boiler House used to open for Fleetwood Mac in London. So you get to know people a bit. Isn't it funny, though, how it's
joined,
quite organic?
They had three guitarists, didn't they? Yeah. Jeremy Spencer was in there, Peter Green and Danny.
Yeah. And, of course, I think that's really that time, and that's really how Danny Kirwan got to play with Fleetwood Mac, really. And that's a lovely story, the way that, you know, I love stories where people are nurtured by other musicians.
Yeah.
And given opportunities. And in those days, and people believed in people's abilities and wanted to help people get on instead of going, who do you think you are?
Yeah.
Not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner, because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance.
NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still lights of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Keyes, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
The revolution will not be televised by the incredible Gil Scott-Heron. What a man.
He was an icon. And was he known as the first rapper?
Yeah.
Or MC?
He's considered the first rapper MC ever.
Yeah. Because he was doing stuff there. I mean, you know, all that time ago that was just completely different. And he was a poet, Prince Louis, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. That was first recorded. He was a poet, which is I quite like that when I hear that description of people, musicians describing themselves as poets as well, because sometimes I think lyricists and the lyrics get pushed to the side because everyone's kind of in immediate satisfaction with the groove and with the melody. And yet the lyrics for me, I love that because it adds depth over time, and you can listen to a song and then sometimes the words catch you. But yeah, that was first recorded in 1970 on an album called Small Talk at 125th and Lennox. And that was originally recorded with congas and bongo drums. And then he re-recorded it again. And it was the B-side of Home is Where the Hatred Is, which is a single that he released from the album Pieces of a Man. What a great title as well. Home is Where the Hatred Is.
Amazing.
Deep.
Well, I first... I knew about Gil Scott-Heron. I heard this track. But what really brought it to the fore, I was in San Francisco in a bar called Cafe Trest, or it's a cafe bar. And it's a pretty famous place. And I went into the loos there, and on the back of the door, the loo door, was actually scratched and in with a pen or a knife. The revolution will not be televised in a really lovely like font that they did. It was really artistically done, and I took a picture of it, and I've still got it kicking around on my website, so I might post it on our Starlight Campbell page actually. It's a really cool photograph.
And then I
looked at it and thought, wow, it's that song. And then I went back to the song and started listening to a lot more Gil Scott-Heron, and he's super cool, you know.
Do you know, I must confess, I don't really know much about his music or his work at all. So it's been quite fascinating for me. He was born in Chicago in 1949, and his mum's called Bobby.
No.
Which I thought was lovely. And she was an opera singer. Get out of here. And his dad, Gil, was a Jamaican football player. They used to call him the Black Arrow because he was the first black man to play for Celtic Football Club in Glasgow.
No.
Yeah. Isn't that just amazing stuff?
Fantastic.
It's just, and then you go, and then it says, oh yeah, that Gil influenced and foreshadowed later African-American music genres like hip-hop and neo-soul. And it's just, this guy, he's just, he had a really intelligent head on his shoulders, you know, and he looked at the world in such a beautiful way. I was reading, I can't recite it verbatim, but he went for an entrance exam in some school because he moved around a bit, and they were saying to get a scholarship, and he was saying, so how would you feel when you see your classmates rolling up in a big limo? And he turned around and said, well, how would you feel, because you can't afford one either. Exactly.
Wow. And remember, folks, the revolution will not be televised.
Black roof country, no gold payments, tired starlings. Silver horses ran down moonbeams in your dark eyes. Dawnlight smile on you leaving my contentment. Tired starving.
White Room by Cream.
The mighty Cream.
Jack Bruce on bass. You know, we haven't mentioned bass any time in
this show.
Show.
No, because it's a constant in my head, and sometimes I just don't talk about it, really.
Mm.
But the bass line on that, obviously short scale, very much Jack Bruce. I love the bass on that, and I don't want to talk about the bass. You know what, there's a part of that song that grates me as well.
What is it?
Well, I've got to confess, I don't really rate Pete Brown as a lyricist.
Mm.
And I know that, basically, there was a poet called Pete Brown who wrote with Jack Bruce. He was brought on board to write with Ginger Baker, but he got better with Jack. And, you know, when I look at the lyrics and when I play White Room, I love playing the music, but I just think the words are lazy and inane and a little bit crap, really.
Well, they are very, very unusual because the way they're structured and very difficult sort of to remember because there's no story there. It's sort of, it's a bit too clever for its own good. I know what you mean.
Yeah, so there's a bit of me that gets annoyed by that because there's no flow with the storyline for me in that. And I love all that kind of, you know, the time signature when you've got that 5-4 at the beginning because it's slightly different, so it just comes in on that after that extra beat. And, I mean, that was released in August 1968. It was a single from the studio half of the double album of Cream's Wheels of Fire. So that was kind of cool. And this is interesting as well. They released it in September 68 in the USA and they released it 4 months later in the UK. Now, why is that?
Well, Led Zeppelin were releasing Led Zeppelin. Well, that might have something to do with it.
No.
I don't know.
Well, you don't know, but all these things, when you see it on paper, you think, well, there must have been some reason for doing that. And guess who was the producer?
No, go on.
Felix.
Papa Paldi.
See?
Yeah, now we know about Felix. He's a good man.
Yes. Or was it Pappalardi?
Pappalardi. Yeah.
I always think Pappalardi sounds a bit sort of like he's got a big ass.
Oh, what? Sorry about that. Sorry about that. But that's made me laugh. That. But the other thing about that track as well, I don't like the drums.
Don't you?
No, I didn't rate Ginger Baker at all, honestly. And everybody goes, oh, you know, but, you know, I never saw Cream live. And I know probably we're going to get a trillion emails now about this. But, you know, by watching them live and listening and on YouTube and listening to the live tracks, you know, they were, I think, a lot better live. Rather like Deep Purple were, because Deep Purple studio albums, I really don't like, to tell you the truth. Yeah. Made in Japan is the only one that really cuts it.
I remember. Mm. And can I tell you one more thing that annoys me? I'm sorry to moan about this track because I know that
so
many people... because I really like it. At the same time, when I sit here and actually listen to it and I think about what I enjoyed about it, I always imagine Jack Bruce, when he sings, wearing a headscarf.
No, this is just too much.
We're
really giving a massive critique to one of the greatest rock bands ever to be. Because they really are. I mean, the live versions and the live Cream stuff was outstanding. And I mean, of course, Eric Clapton went on to even greater things.
I love that song. But when you there are certain aspects of White Room. As a whole, it's a genius for me. I love it.
Mm.
But there are certain aspects that you kind of overlook because it's almost like you're not allowed to say anything bad.
Mm.
And I'm just trying to be honest about that, really.
I do like the song structure as well of that. And I think that's why we like it. Because it's not standard blues. No. It's not standard rock and roll. It had the 5-4 in. You know, the chord things are quite different, you know, for the rock at that time.
Yeah. And you can really play it with a bit of punch as well.
You certainly do.
It's not time to make a change. Just relax, take it easy. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to know. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. I was once like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on. Take your time, think a lot. Why, think of everything you've got, for you will still be here tomorrow, but your dreams may not. How can I try to explain? When I do, he turns away again. It's always been the same, same old story. From the moment I could talk, I was ordered to listen. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go. Make a change, just sit down, take it slowly. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to go through. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. All the times that I've cried, keeping all the things I knew inside. It's hard, but it's harder to ignore it. If they were right, I'd agree. But it's them they know, not me. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go.
You're listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was Father and Son by Yusuf Islam, formerly known as Cat Stevens, of course.
Yeah, I absolutely love that song. It's remarkable. Amazing.
And you talk about lyrics. Now, we've gone from White Room, where they were sort of unintelligible and slightly a bit arty, to something here that is got, it packs a serious punch and always brings me to tears, this song. Always brings me to tears. I just adore the sentiment behind it. I think that the delivery is fantastic. Very simply produced by Paul Samwell Smith, who was formerly the Yardbirds, of course. Mm-hmm. A relatively unknown session cast on it, you know. But yeah. His voice. And, I mean, he is a great songwriter. I mean, he always has been. I mean, you know, you look at what Wild World was on that T for the Tillam album. And, you know, he's written some amazing stuff.
Yeah.
And I always remember seeing him on Jules Holland. And he played this on his own with an acoustic guitar. And I wept. I just broke down because it was a magnificent performance. Not just good, magnificent. You know, and he could still do it, and it was not all that long ago. Incredible. And, of course, as a father, you know, it sort of, it does connect, you know. Although I've always let the boys do what they want to do, you know. But this is talking about, you know, a father not understanding why a son would want to go away and leave. Yeah.
I saw Cat Stevens, or Yusuf, at Cropredy a few years ago when he came out of... No, he went away for ages, didn't he?
Yeah.
And it was Richard Thompson was there. Stevie Wonder was playing as well.
Oh.
So what? It was an amazing night.
And I felt
so honoured. In fact, I filmed a whole lot from high up at the field because I knew my friend Shelley's son, Harley Tomlinson, loves Cat Stevens. So I filmed it for Harley on my really bad camera, but at least he had it, you know, because I wanted to share that with him. But it's... It's quite interesting with Cat Stevens, because I know he changed his name, but when you go back to looking at him and when you say change the name, what I mean is that obviously he changed his identity, really, didn't he? He left all the songwriting and all that kind of glitz of that music world, and Father and Son was originally written as part of a proposed musical project, which is going to star Nigel Hawthorne, you know, from the guy from Yes Minister.
I do.
So, well, it was going to be called Revolutia, which is set during the Russian Revolution. And it was also potentially going to be a film. But then in 1969, he contracted tuberculosis. So the project was shelved and he was near death. He was really, really poorly. He spent months in hospital and spent a year recuperating. And during that time, he started to kind of, I suppose he was just lying there. I think you start to question aspects of your life. So he said he went from that show business environment and you find yourself in hospital getting injections day in, day out, and people around you are dying, and it certainly changes your perspective. So he got down to thinking about himself. It seemed almost as if he had his eyes shut before. So after, when he did recuperate, he took up meditation, yoga, became a vegetarian, and I think that really was a complete life-changing experience, which I'm sure, in fact, many people do go through that. Because you think you're going to live forever, don't you? And then an illness happens and everything suddenly just becomes so irrelevant, doesn't it? Except my nanny used to say to me, your health is your wealth.
Absolutely.
shot, 'cause the man from Mars stopped eating cars and eating bars, and now he only eats guitars. Yeah!
Rapture by the incredible Blondie from their fifth studio album, Auto American, released in 1980.
Produced by Mike Chapman, who, of course, a very famous producer who did The Sweet, Susie Quattro, all those early...
Really?
Yeah. And Chin and Chapman were the writing team behind basically The Sweet and a lot of those early songs.
Wow.
And he has wholesalely nicked... In this track, right?
What you say?
Well, it's Ian Dure and the Blockheads, right? Because
yeah.
That whole feel and that whole thing that was recorded 2 years before with Ian Dure and the Blockheads, Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick and those that great album, New Books of Pansies. And he has wholesale nicked it. Even down to the guitar solo at the end, the horns, the whole thing. But I tell you one thing, those horns are really smooth at the end. You can tell it's done in LA. It's that smooth Hollywood horn sound, man. Absolutely tremendous. But great track. And talking about rapping, that was the first track to have rapping at number one.
Yeah,
American
in the US Billboard charts.
That's right. The first one to have rapping.
It's funny because I don't really see it as Debbie actually rapping, but she is. It's because it's kind of it doesn't have it's her style, but it's not like rap as I know it. It's really funny to think it's just a spoken word to me.
Yeah,
it's funny, isn't it? Which is rap.
Yeah,
but rap rhythmic, for me has a melodic rhythm and a rhythm to it as well. I know that has... I'm getting myself tangled up. How do I express that?
I know exactly what you're saying, but I think because, it's Debbie Harry doing it.
Yeah.
And you don't expect her to do it.
No.
And, you know, when she's talking, it sounds slightly different what you'd expect rap to be. Because, of course, that was influenced, wasn't it, by... Does she not mention in there the Grandmaster Flash?
That's right. She name-checked the Fab Five Freddy and Grandmaster Flash.
Mm.
And what was quite interesting, this was the first ever rap video on MTV. And a few months ago, I discovered the graffiti artist Jean-Michel Basquiat. He was a great friend of Andy Warhol.
Right.
Well, we have. Well, one of his prints.
We do.
On the wall.
We do indeed.
Because I love his work completely. And it was quite funny, though, but Basquiat actually makes a cameo appearance in their video because Grandmaster Flash, who was hired to show up, didn't show up. So isn't that great? So you've got that kind of urban edge, which I really like. I really like their the passion, the feel.
Fabulous record. And Blondie generally. I mean, we do listen. Because on this show, we play stuff on it that we listen to in our own home. This is, you know, it's all on vinyl. We listen to it. And, you know, what you're listening to is our... music that we just play and listen to all the time, you know, including Cream, which we had a bit of a go at before, and Blondie. But Blondie, as soon as Blondie comes on or Ian Dury, you can see us strutting our stuff
around the
house, normally with a glass of vino tinto.
See, what was I went to see Blondie at the Manchester Apollo a few years ago now. And the one thing that has always struck me about Debbie Harry is that I always thought she was a really good egg and a really good woman, because when Chris Stein fell ill, she stuck by him.
Yeah.
So, and that for me, growing up, I just thought, how wonderful, how beautiful that they had a true relationship that wasn't just there because they were famous or they played in the band together.
And she was one of the most desirable women at that time, weren't they, for years and years and years, you know?
But do you know what her birth name is?
No.
Angela Tremble.
No. Now you've hidden that from me. Angela Tremble.
What
a
name.
My knees are trembling. That's incredible.
She's had a bit of a story, actually, because she was adopted at 3 months old.
No.
Yeah, and I was reading up about it, and apparently Debbie tried to find a birth mother in the 1980s, and her birth mother wouldn't have anything to do with her.
No.
Yeah, really, I mean, that must be hard. So anyway, so Debbie Harry moves to New York City in the late 60s. And you'll never believe this. She worked as a secretary in New York at the BBC radio office.
No.
Oh, yeah. And it goes on. Incredible. So she was obviously, you know that you do a waitress job. So she worked at Max's Kansas City. She was a go-go dancer in a discotheque in New Jersey and a Playboy bunny.
No.
Isn't that interesting?
It sure is.
And then you get all that time where she was down there. She was she used to frequent Studio 54 and hanging out with all the Warhol thing. And you could really see that time and how it all came together. And she was in different bands and singing. She was in a band called Wind in the Willows. And it's actually quite an incredible journey she's been on. And the fact that she took some time out and they got back together again. I love Debbie Harry.
Well, when she came back with that single later on, I mean, she was away for
Maria.
Years. Maria, yeah.
Stroke of
what,
genius.
What
that.
A great single that was.
Absolutely.
My goodness. It came and I thought, wow, you know, much respect. And Chris Stein, he's a lovely guy as well. He's still got that floppy hair thing going on, you know.
Yeah.
But the great couple, great rock and roll couple, great story.
Great song.
Ah, great song.
Time's up, you know, for this week's episode.
Oh, not again.
It goes so quick, doesn't it?
Unbelievable.
No,
well,
last track you've chosen specifically.
Well, John Heisman passed away earlier on this week. A mighty drummer and band leader indeed. Very, very cool guy. Clem Clemson, who was a guitar player, you know, wrote a lovely eulogy, as did the New York Times. A great thing. But this track, Fighting Talk, was from Coliseum 2, which was one of his later bands, because he was in the Graham Bond Organisation, because he replaced Ginger Baker, I think, when he went to join Cream, actually.
Crikey.
Because Graham Bond Organisation, so was Jack Bruce in it, so there's a link to this whole show here. But he joined, and he was in John Mayall's Bruce Baker as well, wasn't he?
I know. Well, quite a few people were, but I still think it's quite kudos, actually, to be in John's band.
Amazing. But this track, again, Fighting Talk, is got Gary Moore in it, and it's got Don Airey and John Mole on bass. And I learnt this, and it was one of those tracks that I learnt when I was sort of in that jazz rock sort of phase, and it's absolutely marvellous. It's a marvellous song and not played enough on the radio.
Oh, and I also wanted to say as well, they had a cool wife called Barbara Thompson, who was a saxophonist. And I always think that's lovely, isn't it, when you've got a musician as your partner.
Sure is. So that's it.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll play you out with Coliseum 2. But if you want to get in contact with us, we're on Instagram, Starlight Campbell, Twitter at Susie and Simon, and Facebook, of course.
And the show's available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio. So please tell your friends.